time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for October 6th, 2018. I have two great guests this evening, and I don't want to waste any time getting to them. The Walk Bike Places Conference took place a couple of weeks ago in New Orleans, and the way I found out about it was from my first guest, Christine Acosta. Christine came to the work she's doing after caring for her father until his death from complications of diabetes. She always rode a bike for transportation and recreation, and combined with the determination to make a difference, Christine founded Pedal Power Promoters in Tampa, Florida. Her organization puts together cycling and business, helping businesses become bicycle friendly, as well as helping cycling organizations further their objectives. Christine will be up in a moment. Then after our break, I speak with one of my all-time sports heroes. In 1982, 23-year-old Julie Moss literally crawled across the finish line of the Hawaiian Ironman in Kona, Hawaii, catapulting the sport into the spotlight and changing her life forever. Now approaching 60, Julie's journey is told in her new book, Crawl of Fame. The book documents her life, successes and failures, and her honest, forthright understanding of what it takes to be a champion, a wife, a mother, and still continue to be true to herself. The story is riveting. The conversation is lively and fun, and I'm very excited to be able to share it with you. So let's first head to Tampa to speak with Christine Acosta from Pedal Power Promoters. Hi, Christine. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be your guest.
Well, I want to know all about you and your organization and bicycle advocacy. We haven't been actually talking about it much the last couple of months, so I'm really glad to be able to catch up with you. What got you into bicycle advocacy?
I came to bicycle advocacy kind of late in life. I am what AARP calls an encore career person. So I cared for my father at the end of his life, and he had diabetes. And I decided to forego my plans to resume a corporate life and just became determined to do something to positively affect public health. And that's what brought me to bicycle advocacy.
So let's say walking could have been a way to do it, swimming. What brought you to cycling itself?
Well, I've been a bicycle commuter myself.
Ah.
It's my favorite mode of transportation. And bicycling actually helped me cope with some of the most difficult times, not just caring for dad, but other challenging times throughout my life. And I just wanted to connect with others in the community that also felt that joy and love of cycling.
That's really good. Your organization is a little bit different from what we think about when we think about cycling advocacy. You know, it's something to do with recreation or teaching skills or transportation, but you actually engage in a type of advocacy that makes so much sense. One I hadn't even thought or heard of until you and I connected a few weeks ago. Explain Pedal Power Promoters, what you do and what programs you offer.
Happy to. Pedal Power Promoters is a small company, and I work with public and private enterprises to promote bicycle friendliness. So that takes a couple of different forms and shapes in our community in the Tampa St. Pete area. I am engaged, and my other Pedal Power Promoters team members engaged in the public outreach efforts that are around cycle tracks, trails development, things like that. So we educate the public, and I kind of like to call us professional cheerleaders for bicycle facilities. And we also have developed bicycle-friendly business programs in a couple of areas. And this is where we develop and design custom programs that enable us to connect with businesses that want to be recognized for their bicycle friendliness.
So give us an example of a business like that.
Well, there's so many to choose from.
Oh, well, pick one you really love. Well, of course, then that's the thing. Okay, let's exclude everybody else. No.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a strong connection between craft beer brewing and, in our case, artisan craft roasting coffee, where the businesses really are very committed to their local communities, and active transportation really resonates with their corporate culture. So we do have a couple of local breweries that are bicycle-friendly certified in our area. We also have a very large hospital, so there's health and wellness enterprises. We have the engineering and planner firms locally who want to be able to be one step ahead in their competition for new work in our community that involves active transportation facilities. So it's important for them to kind of walk the walk and bike the bike in terms of being recognized on the national level as bicycle friendly. So there's just a huge variety. Any business, any number of employees, any industry can apply to be bicycle friendly.
So you actually facilitate the business to the bicycle friendly designation from the League of American Bicyclists, right?
That's exactly right. You got it. We use the framework provided by the League of American Bicyclists, and any business can go onto their website and create an application. We work with the public enterprises like cities or transportation management organizations who want to assist the local businesses through the application process. And so we meet with them. We develop a custom action plan that can include anything from developing bicycle commuter services for a large employee population or adding bike parking. We teach bicycle safety as a part of the application process. So we do a lot to build the narrative around a business's bicycle friendliness.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Christine Acosta. She is the founder and owner of, ready for this, guys? It's alliteratively beautiful, Pedal Power Promoters. And I want to back up a second and talk a little bit about the engineering and transportation planners, city planners, only insofar as their willingness, I don't know how to say this exactly without offending them, because I find that many times transportation planners don't really get cycling. And they'll plan something that they think will work, and it often doesn't. So what kinds of things are you doing to make sure that a planning company and a city get together and actually make something that works, as opposed to, well, let's put a bike lane here and find out that, well, the buses park in it, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Oh, so true. We do see that. We see that everywhere. So I'll give you an example of what we do. We might take a group of the office dwellers from a firm on a bike ride. Even though people work at these planning organizations, they may not be bicycle commuters themselves.
Right.
And so we do education, or we might have the senior person from the firm greet and invite on a bike ride, so that you have, you know, the top firm leadership expressing their support of cycling, and then treating everyone to a picnic lunch after we pedal for a little while. And meanwhile, the staff is enjoying their community and their bike facilities in their own city.
Do you have bike share in Tampa, St. Pete?
We do. We have fabulous bike share here. It's a regional system. We have the smart bikes. So the bikes are smart, not the hubs.
The bikes are smart, not the hubs. What does that mean exactly?
Well, this is so great, Diane. The bike share evolution has just been fantastic. And we have a state-of-the-art program in our region, insofar as the bikes themselves are each on a satellite tracking system.
Oh.
You don't run out of bike parking for the bikes like you might in other cities like New York. So the app-based system enables you to identify where a bike is. And maybe if you're a block or two away, you can reserve the bike because you're on your way to get to the bike. I don't know if you've ever been to a bike share hub, a rack, and you find that all the bikes are gone, or maybe you spot someone from, this happened to me once in Washington, D.C. I spotted someone half a block away, and we saw each other. We both picked up our pace, and he beat me to the last bike on the rack. So,
kind of a bummer. I was like, dude, I'm wearing heels. Let me have the bike, you know.
But he's like, no.
Yeah. So our bike share system is able to provide all the data of where the bikes go. So when the hubs are smart, in other words, when you take a bike or lock it back into the hub in the older models of the bike share system, the system users and possibly the city know that you took a bike from one hub and later, sometime later, you put it in maybe across town, but they don't know where you pedaled. In our case, our provider is able to provide the city with all the data of where people are using the bikes. So we know which intersections need more bike love from a facilities perspective. We know when cyclists might be on the sidewalk, but we'd rather they had a bike facility and they, you know, maybe there's poor bike facility on any given street. And we know perhaps where cyclists might be getting a little bit lost and we need to bolster our wayfinding. So there's just so much good data that comes from the bike share system that we have and that some other cities have.
Wow. That's like a duh. It seems to me, why would you do it any other way? But then, you know, it's an evolution. I get it. I absolutely
do. It is.
So let's go back to the bicycle-friendly business for a second.
Sure.
A business becomes bicycle-friendly. What are the benefits to the business? I understand what might be the benefits to the city, but maybe I don't even understand that. So let's do both.
Sure. So I want to back up and just describe that the bicycle-friendly business certification is a little bit like LEED certification, if you know the green building terminology. Sure. So they're very similar insofar as the recognition comes in degrees. So a business might be certified as bronze, silver, gold, or platinum. And so there are degrees of bicycle-friendliness in the award structure. That said, there are all different types of businesses and therefore all different rationale for wanting to be certified as bike friendly, but it usually boils down to whatever resonates most with their corporate and business culture. So it's going to be the health and wellness of their employees. It's going to be the value that they place on a sustainable community, the environment. Oftentimes, transportation is, especially in communities like ours, where we don't have a lot of offerings from a transit perspective, single occupancy vehicle transportation is the most expensive or second most expensive thing that a household bears. So for employers to be able to support their employees who would like to live a car optional lifestyle, it's hugely impactful on their ability to recruit employees and retain employees. So there are just so many benefits that a business can have, and the business decides which is most valuable to them.
Very interesting. Once again, I'm speaking with Christina Costa. We're talking about becoming a bicycle-friendly business, having bicycle-friendly businesses in your community, and the work that Pedal Power Promoters, her organization, does. Down in Tampa, St. Pete, Florida, and that brought me to another question I had about the size of the area, the region. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about in terms of numbers of people who may or may not. Now, everybody thinks of Florida as being quote unquote old people, which of course it's not. It has to have a completely sustainable range of ages. So what goes on in Tampa, St. Pete, and how big is that area for these services?
Tampa, St. Pete is being recognized as a super region now. And so we kind of jokingly call ourselves the other Bay Area. So similar to San Francisco, Oakland, you know, large regional and diverse landscape of communities, cities, neighborhoods, that is exactly what the Tampa Bay area is like. So we have a very large population, very diverse. We are not the old population that we are sometimes perceived as, you know, that's what comes to mind. I like to tell people, if you have not been to St. Pete, Florida, in a few years, then you will be shocked to come back because it is so vibrant and so youthful. This is not your grandpa's St. Pete or Tampa.
Right.
Yeah, a lot is changing. And economically, the region has a tremendous quality of life. A lot of businesses are relocating here. But we do face the challenges that a lot of cities are facing with transportation. We are not recognized as a bike-friendly region specific smaller, you know, the urban cores are making a lot of progress, and they, in fact, are becoming much more bike friendly. But Florida is among the worst in the states for bicycle friendliness. We are pretty frequently rated as the most dangerous by design. If you're familiar, I think you've covered that report by Smart Growth America. So we have our challenges for sure.
Let's switch gears a second. You did attend, if I am not mistaken, the Walk Bike Places Symposium last week?
I sure did. This was my second time attending the conference. This time it was in New Orleans, and 2 years ago it was in Vancouver.
Right.
And there's just so much to learn. I always leave that conference just completely and totally energized and delighted with the progress that's being made towards active transportation just being a standard expectation in our communities. We certainly have a long way to go with our built environment in a lot of cases, and Florida specifically. But there are so many great examples. And what I like to see, I guess if I could cite like one giant takeaway.
Yeah, sure.
From the conference is, in the last few years, I've seen and really am now seeing much more so the alignment of health and wellness and transportation partnering and being in step with one another, pun intended, for making our communities a walkable and bikeable. We had the American Heart Association present at the conference. We had the Centers for Disease Control now partnering with the League of American Bicyclists, AARP, of course, with their livable communities. We just have a lot of voices saying the same thing. And I think that's going to really result in the change that we need and that we want in our country and in our neighborhoods, where walking and biking is not a freakish thought, but something that is a viable option more than not. So, and that just really, really is very exciting to me.
It is exciting. And it's so interesting. It's one of those things that when it happens, it's that overnight sensation that took 50 years. You know, there's so many examples of that.
All of a sudden.
Yeah. I have a kind of a question which you may decline to answer, but how is Pedal Power Promoters funded?
Well, I don't mind answering that at all.
Okay.
I'm a small business, a social enterprise, just an LLC. I am contracted with the clients that I mentioned earlier, cities and transportation management organizations, downtown partnerships, and the like, through the funding that they have, sometimes through the Department of Transportation for commuter assistance funds or health and wellness programming. It's really kind of a mixed bag, honestly, where my clients come from. And then, of course, my other clients are the businesses themselves. Usually my funding comes from the public sector enterprise, and the businesses pay for the application fee themselves to the League of American Bicyclists. That's not something I charge the businesses for. It's a small business I work very closely with and have also been the executive director for the local nonprofit, Walk Bike Tampa. And so that's been I work in very, very close partnership with them. I work as their fulfillment agent for some of the bike parking consultations that they need to provide in the community. So it's really a tightly knit group of people and organizations that care deeply about our neighborhoods, our cities, our businesses, and bikeability in general.
Do you have any projects that are coming online in the next few months or in 2019? I know we're sort of wrapping up 2018 right now.
The projects that I have in my queue right now will carry me into 2019, and that includes the promotion and strategic stakeholder engagement for two of the biggest bicycle facilities that are happening in each county where I live. We have an urban cycle track, a superhighway, if you will, for bicycling that is being designed right now in the city of Tampa. That's called our Green Spine. And then across the bay in the St. Pete area in the Pinellas County, there's the extension of a fabulous trail. Diane, this Pinellas Trail is in part a rail conversion. It's been around for a long time, but to see it really blossom and positively affect the lives of so many in that county, it's just very, very exciting. So I'm working on those two. And then I have engagements from different business districts and so on to keep going with the bicycle friendly certification.
Wow. Like you have nothing to do. So I have just two quick questions. One, of course, is to let my listeners know how to find out more about the work you're doing. But the other is, are you setting examples in such a way that other communities are wondering what you're doing and how you're doing it? Are they coming to you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is really, as I mentioned, Pedal Power Promoters is a social enterprise, meaning it's not about the bottom line as much as it is positively affecting my clients, the constituents, and the public. So we share openly what our programming is and what it looks like and our recommendations. I had the benefit of being on a panel last year. The League of American Bicyclists has its annual summit, and I was one of four representatives that were engaged to talk about how to get businesses to be bicycle advocates themselves. And this is a one giant step in that direction for engaging private, you know, business to speak up and declare their commitment for cycling. I'm sorry, what was your other, was there another part of the question?
Whether other people were coming to you to find out how you're doing the work you're doing and having the successes you're having.
Yes. In addition to being on that panel, I do receive inquiries through my website, pedalpowerpromoters.com. This might also answer your other question about how to hear about me, but I share information and do telephone conference calling and coaching when people ask me to, and I present at our local advocacy organizations and public committees and things like that whenever I have the opportunity and whenever I'm asked to.
Yes, I guess, in fact, you did answer the other question. Perfect. That's awesome. Well, this has been really interesting, and you are a really important supporter for my show, which I really appreciate that you have some interest in what we're doing, and I actually have a lot of interest in what you're doing. Everybody knows that advocacy is a big part of advocacy and safety are two big parts of the work that I do. So I appreciate what you're doing, and I thank you for taking time to talk with me today. And if I ever get myself down to Florida, which I probably should when it's like 16 degrees and snow on the ground here in Cleveland, I'll look you up. That would be fun.
You definitely are welcome to come down here. I want you to come to Florida. I want everybody to come down here and experience our bike culture. And I just want to commend you and say happy 8th birthday to the Outspoken Cyclist and keep up the great work.
Thanks. And you too. Appreciate it, Christine. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye. Christine Acosta joined me from the offices of Pedal Power Promoters in Tampa, Florida. Say that three times fast. If you're interested, log on to the pedalpowerpromoters.com website and you can see what the organization can do to help you. There's even an easy-to-fill-out application to become a bicycle-friendly business in the Tampa and St. Pete areas. So let's take a short break and then I'll be back to share my conversation with Julie Moss about her new book, Crawl of Fame. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. My next guest literally made triathlon a household name in 1982 when she burst out of the transition area at the Hawaii Ironman in the top 10 at the start of the marathon. 24 miles in, she was in first place, and things began to fall apart. ABC was there to document every step and every falter until she crawled across the finish line in second place. The incident was broadcast worldwide, and Julie Moss's life changed forever, as did the sport of triathlon. I caught up with Julie at her home in California. Hi, Julie. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Diane, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm looking forward to this.
I can't believe it's been 36 years since you turned triathlon into an amazing sport with something that you probably look back on and go, did I really do that? But I'm really happy to be able to speak with you.
Oh, well, the time has flown, hasn't it? I mean, I think back, it doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but I'm about to turn 60. So that registers, you know, across the board, athletic or not. And so, yeah, it was a long time ago. But it in some ways, it feels very fresh.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Like when you close your eyes, you're right there. So you were 23. And before we talk about you know, that breathtaking finish. And still, I watched it, by the way. I went back since I was preparing for this, and I called up the YouTube video, and I sat there and cried again. You know, everybody cries. You can't not cry. And the whole story is just amazing. But can we start like way back in your childhood and tell us how perhaps one of the things from your book, and we are going to talk about your book, your new book, and when I got it. So I've had it for a while. Jessica Case is your publishing lady. And she always sends at Pegasus Books. And she always sends me stuff ahead of time. And it came in. I didn't even have to look. I said, I saw Crawl of Fame and I went, oh, it has to be about Julie. So it's
good. I'm glad. That was the whole point.
Right. Exactly. I mean, who else would put a title like that out there? Right. But of course, there are a lot of things reading it that I didn't know about you and that nobody would have known without you writing this book. And let's start with your childhood and your relationship with your dad, because I think it shaped you.
Yeah, it did. And that was a hard one to kind of delve into because I had such little information. It's just feelings that I had from being little. And because my dad really wasn't a part of our family from fourth grade on, I just had to hang on to these vivid memories of him. And what I realized was he was very athletic, very charming, very outgoing. And because it was always this tension in the household around my dad that he made himself scarce. And so my moments with him were few and far between. And I think I tried to shine and tried to get his attention. And I think on some level, I was trying to get him to stay and stick around longer. And so I was the daredevil. Whatever he did, I tried to mimic in some way. And I mean, it's clear to me now as an adult, but looking back on it, I even had this sense that I was trying to impress Daddy.
You know, I think a lot of kids do that, and especially little girls whose fathers may have wanted a boy. And you have an older brother, I know, but not by much. He's, what, 14 months older than you?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, he was very artistic and sensitive. He wasn't the boy that I think my dad envisioned having. Hmm. So I think on two levels, I sort of, you know, tried to make up and to just and to stand out in my own right.
Well, you certainly did, and you certainly have. So let's look back a little bit at your school years. I want to kind of hurry through this part so we can get to
the juicy stuff. Okay.
Yeah, the juicy stuff. Well, not just the juicy stuff, but there's some really fascinating things that just sort of resonated with me in reading your book. You know, there are a lot of things like, well, we'll get through it. We'll get there.
Okay.
Okay. I don't want to hurry it.
Well, I can sum up the school years pretty quickly.
Okay, go ahead.
I think I was a good student in elementary school and junior high, but by the time it got to high school, I was all about the social side. And I'd been told I had been tested because I'd been so outspoken and so hard to handle in a class that the teacher thought there was something wrong with me and she had me tested. And it turns out my IQ was pretty good. And with my mother being an educator, she pointed this out to me. And so I decided, well, I guess I'm smart, so I don't have to try so hard. I did not try hard in school. I was most focused on social, on having fun, on fitting in finding my niche. And school was always an afterthought, and I did the minimum to get by.
Okay, that pretty much sums it up, except for the sports side. So one of the things that I noticed reading was that you didn't see yourself as a team leader in sports, and yet you wanted to be part of sports. But did you see yourself as a natural athlete? Because you did a lot of things.
Yeah, I think when I kind of focused my attention on something, I would have some success with it. When I started high school, I had started surfing then. So that was really my first love. And the athletics that I tried in school, I tried a different sport every year for 4 years. I made the JV team, and I was happy just to put on the uniform, hang out with my friends, and literally sick to my stomach when I was called in to play. The pressure of that was just, yeah. So I was active. I was adventurous. And so, but not necessarily, you know, athletic. That's a skill set. And I was too impatient to really spend too much time learning those skills. I was on to the next thing.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Julie Moss. She has written a new book called Crawl of Fame. And if you don't know who Julie Moss is, all you have to do is go to YouTube, type in Julie Moss, Crawl of Fame, and you'll know immediately. It's interesting. I've been asking some of my yoga students, do you remember? And you can always tell the generation by who says yes and who says no.
Interesting.
Know, yeah, it's very interesting.
YouTube does help us keep a longer shelf life for sure. But yeah, that 1982 Iron Man does come up. There it is for all to see.
Yeah, it does indeed. And I'm sure you have replayed it like a gazillion times. So let's move to your senior project, because that is what sort of launched everything.
Well, I approached my senior project. It was a requirement to graduate from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and here in California, in Central California, kind of near the beach, but also very much an agricultural school. And I picked it because it was near a good surf break, and it accepted me. So there I was in school. And again, just sort of, you know, going to class, really enjoying my independence and not worrying so much about a career or what I was going to do after college. At just passing my classes was enough to handle. And there I was thinking I needed a senior project as a kinesiology major. And I watched the 1981 Iron Man in Wide World of Sports, and I saw the Iron Man for the very first time. John Howard, the Olympic cyclist, was the men's winner that year. But there was also Scott Molina was carried off in a stretcher. I mean, I was just so mesmerized with this race. Even though I had no skill set to even think about doing it, I just thought it was in Hawaii, so that spoke to me as a surfer. And I thought, these are gorgeous men running around this island in Speedos. That looks kind of good. You know, a 22-year-old brain just said, hey, there's a lot of hot guys in Hawaii. Let's go there and do that. And literally, I signed up within a couple weeks. I mean, it was this, I couldn't shake the feeling that this was something I wanted to do. Not that I wanted to do it. I wanted to just be a part of it. And how to do it, I'd figure that out on the fly.
Which indeed you did, because one of the interesting pieces of the quote unquote pre-training for this race was pretty unconventional by today's standards. You didn't have great equipment. You didn't have a sponsorship. You didn't have much of anything. And yet there you were.
There I was. And I knew that my biggest weapon was that I wasn't there to impress anybody. I was just there to finish, graduate, and then get on with my life. And I had a great attitude. I wasn't afraid of it. I was just there. I was ready to just take it on, whatever it was. And, you know, in an endurance event, your attitude is everything.
That is so true. So I want to do the little event part, big event part, so that we can move from there. Because I think life changed so dramatically for you and for the world of triathlon after your race. Not anybody else's. Your race was what made triathlon, like catapulted it into the stratosphere for sports. So you found yourself in second place after the transition of the bike to the run. How the hell did that happen?
Who knew? I was so busy chatting up the cameramen who were coming around me. I was again, very absorbed in the race, getting things that I needed to eat, just thinking like, this wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, you know, from the mouth of the babe. And as we got back into the transition, it was this weird feeling like, now I'm in second. Oh, that means I've got to start really trying. And that was pressure. And I did start to feel some of that pressure of not just doing well because I was in second place, but for the first time feeling like, wow, this is what it feels like to actually do well at something and to kind of take ownership of being good at something. So there was this kind of interesting transformation that was happening within me right at the beginning of the marathon, you know, jumping off the bike. That marathon, I started to think of myself differently, and that just grew over the miles.
Well, and then a pair of helicopters started following you and Kathleen McCartney, who evidently, I guess she had been sick a couple of the days before, and she wasn't feeling really well, and everybody expected her to win, and here you were. And the thing that impressed me was you were 8 minutes ahead and you are running 8 minute miles. So it's obvious she was a mile behind you all that time.
Yeah. And that's where my inexperience really hurt me, because I didn't know how to kind of, you know, amortize that 8 minutes over the next 8 miles. I just felt she was breathing down my neck. That's what it felt like. It felt like she was right there. And so that was a misconception on my part, and just a lot lack of experience racing. This was only my third marathon, and my fourth running race period. So I didn't understand that you could really, you don't have to slow down much. It takes a long time for someone to make up that kind of time on you. So I didn't realize that. So I just kept running as hard as I could until I couldn't. And then I'd walk, I'd regroup, then I'd run as hard as I could. So it started to get pretty agonizing there. Those, at least the last 10K was really agonizing because I'm cramping. I've got fear that this woman's coming to take something that I'm starting to own. And my body was just starting to run out of calories. And things weren't digesting right because their nutrition isn't great. I'd thrown a big chunk of my good nutrition out on the bike course because it was melting and I didn't want to get messy. I mean, just some rookie mistakes. But coming down to that last mile, I was still in the lead. And if I could make it down this long downhill into the town of Kona with a mile to go, I thought I was going to win it.
So should we tell people what happened?
Well, I'm teeing you up.
All right. And swing.
I think it's, I was coming down just when I kind of thought I was going to be able to manage it. We had a slight downhill right before we got onto famed Ali'i Drive, which is the finish line of the Ironman, with a quarter mile to go. And my legs just buckled. And when they buckled underneath me, it wasn't painful. It was just like they just stopped working. And there I crumpled to the ground. And that was pretty scary. It was humiliating because when I lost control of my legs, I lost control of everything in my lower half.
Right.
And believe me, I'd been suffering with a grinding belly for a while. And I just immediately thought this was the time you wanted to crawl into a hole. I just wanted to disappear. And because when I tried to get up, my legs didn't respond. And I was literally sitting there helpless, a helpless mess. And there were the TV cameras on me. And even though I didn't understand how big that was going to play out over time, those cameras, I still understood as a young woman that I was really vulnerable and embarrassed. And so dealing with all those emotions, finally, I just kind of had this inner sense, this inner voice tell me to just forget everything else and get up, just get up, start with that. And so it took a while. And once I was able to get up, I had this sense that, again, I had to start racing. So as soon as I could walk, I'd start to run. And I repeated this falling, getting up three more times until I was really within sight of the finish line. And I thought, this is, I got up. I was coming towards the finish line. There's my mother holding out a flower lei for me to put around my neck. She's so proud of me. And I just wave her off because I thought that will throw me off balance and I will fall. And when I went down for the fourth time, I couldn't get up. I mean, my arms now were not able to support me to even get up. And that's exactly the moment that Kathleen McCartney came by me to win the Ironman, 1982 Ironman, and become champion. And I was devastated. I'm on the ground. I'm devastated. And I thought it was all about winning. I really did. I had put everything in those last hours into this fight to win because that made me something. Something I'd never felt before. And then when I couldn't get up, I had to figure out a way to finish this thing because suddenly, it's this amazing ability when you're stripped raw that you still have this clarity of your inner self. It can still talk to you. And this voice just said, crawl. Get to the finish line. Just crawl. And so I started to crawl and it took me probably about 5 seconds of hanging my head in disappointment to this realization that my life has changed. I mean, I really got it right then and there on the ground, on all fours. I got it that by digging deep within myself, it wasn't necessarily about winning this race. It was about knowing that I had done everything in my power to bring out my best self on that day. And that changed my life. And I think it changed the sport because people could see me do it, motivated them to want to have an experience that they would do whatever it took to reach their goal. Costa. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That is true. So do you actually remember the moment of touching that finish line?
Absolutely, Diane. As I was getting near it, I thought, well, I don't have to crawl over it. I just have to put one hand on it. That'll do. And so I'm here. I reach out one hand, and I roll over on my back. And at some point, I had a picture of this, and I don't have it anymore. I've got a smile on my face, a big smile on my face. And I remember that feeling of just my whole body just smiling and just thinking, I did it. I did it. And then the volunteers came and scooped me up. And all I could think of is, oh, no. And in fact, I said, just take me and drop me in the bay. I'm such a mess. Don't touch me.
Don't get too close.
Drop me in the bay.
Right. Well, and you did have an unbelievable amount of support. I think that poor Kathleen McCartney, when you think back on it, here she won this grueling race, and yet all the attention, all the focus was on you, and rightly so. I mean, you did prove something. First of all, you were not a triathlete until that day, really.
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much.
So it was just an amazing, amazing thing. Before we move on, can we take a short break and we'll be right back?
Sure.
Okay, hang on. For all of you who are listening, I am speaking with Julie Moss. She has written a new book, Crawl of Fame. You can't have it yet. It is coming out later this week. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Okay, we're back, and if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Julie Moss about her new book, Crawl of Fame. It is the 15 meters that created an Ironman triathlon legend, and that is an understatement at best. At best. So let's move on. Everything changed for you from that moment on, pretty much, and some of it had to do with ABC. A lot went on with the organization, with the sports, ABC Wildwater Sports and Jim McKay and all of those guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was pretty interesting when the VP saw what the film was. Everything kind of went into this hyper fast motion of getting the show produced and out within a record time. I think 2 weeks of turnaround was just unheard of back then, and they managed to do it. And so they aired the show really quickly. They knew they had sports magic because they'd been doing this for so long. And Jim McKay, when he saw the footage, he demanded that Kathleen and I be flown out the very next week and to be sitting down in his studio with him, having a conversation. Part of that was because before, you know, we had switchboards that's how they knew they were getting all these calls into ABC when the 1982 Ironman aired for the first time, and people were going crazy. They wanted to know if I was still alive. I mean, that's how dramatic it looked. And so the next week we were flown by Wildwater Sports out to their studio to sit down with Jim McKay so that the American people could see I was still alive. And, to, you know, obviously this story was going viral, for its time.
It became part of the Wide World of Sports opening, as I remember. I don't know if it still is, because I don't even know if they do ABC Wild World of Sports anymore.
No, it's not on anymore. Not the way we used to see it with the poor skier, ski jumper falling. Right. Yeah. And I mean, they had used my image for some things, but they had thought about maybe replacing the ski jumper with me, and I'm really glad they didn't.
Yeah. So. Might have changed the sport yet again. You brought something up in the book, and by the way, I want to make a real quick correction. The book did publish. It published yesterday, October 2nd.
Yes, Amazon is shipping right now. If you go to Amazon.com to order, you'll get it within a couple of days.
What's really, really cool, and this is what I love about the work that I'd get to do, not only did I get your book in paperback form a long time ago, Jess sent me the hardback cover, and it just arrived last week. So I have both.
Oh,
of them.
Cool.
I know.
Yeah, you got it early. Yeah,
I do. So In fact, I think as mine says, advanced reading copy, not for sale. So I'm not, I wasn't even allowed to, you know, I mean, that's why we waited to do this interview. because we wanted to wait until the book actually was published. So tell us tell us about the perception of freak show and everyman or one of us. What does all that mean?
Well, I think, I think Scott Tinley, who's a good friend of mine, he was the men's champion in 1982. I think he was the one who used that in an article. He was quoted as saying, he didn't want the sport to become a freak show, meaning that the more outlandish things people did to try and get to the finish line, that took away from the attention of the athletes who were out there really trying to turn this into a bona fide sport. I mean, obviously, in 1982, we had no idea triathlon was going to become an Olympic sport. But a few had hopes, like Scott Tinley, and to have a professional career as a triathlete. So I think he was worried that that what seemed the spectacle of my finish might taint the sport as a legitimate sport. And what I think is that it spoke to something that was beyond just athleticism. It spoke to the spirit and courage of someone getting to do something that tests them in a way that they might not ever get tested. And this was an opportunity. So it was like the everyman and the elite athlete were sort of coming together in this one sport. And that's something we're very proud of, is that when you enter a race, you're on the start line with the elites in the race. You get to mingle with the elites. You get to have access to the top people on our sport, even if it's your very first triathlon. So that's something I'm very proud of, and I think most of our community really treasures about our sport. But going back to the idea that in 1982, my finish ruffled some feathers for sure. Some of the elite athletes didn't want to turn triathlon into a circus, but I think the overriding message and what people really got from watching the 1982 race, especially my finish, was that if you put your heart and soul into something, you can accomplish a goal you never dreamed possible. And the Ironman somehow became more possible because of my struggle. When you see elite athletes making it seem so fast and so easy, you think, well, yeah, I could never do that. Well, somehow my image allowed people to reconsider something they never thought possible to something that they might want to try. That's just my armchair opinion.
No, I think it's probably very true. I mean, I told you before we actually started our conversation that your race inspired me to put on a race here. And we did it for 3 years. And I saw people who you never would have thought would get into Lake Erie and swim, get on a bike and ride, and then run a half marathon. We did a half Ironman here.
That's industrious for anybody.
It's incredible. And people who just said, I just have to try this. And I know that the inspiration came from what happened at that finish line in Kona that year. So how did it change you moving forward? What changed in your life to sort of direct you? What direction did you suddenly find yourself going that maybe you never thought you were going to do?
Well, I never thought I would pursue a career as a professional athlete. I jokingly say I fell into triathlon. Very funny, I know. Opportunities just kept coming at me because ABC was so successful with putting on a triathlon. NBC wanted one. CBS wanted one. There became this bidding war almost to see who could have the best triathlon in the most exotic location and who could get, the most athletes there. We were given opportunities to travel, to race. If the race didn't offer outright prize money, they certainly paid us for our time to come and do the race. So we were starting to earn a living as triathletes right away, and equal for men and women. At least in for me, I was getting the same opportunities as the men because I was now representing something, a movement in the sport, a moment in the sport. I was a key person in the sport of triathlon that people could recognize and know. So I was getting certainly a lot of opportunities. And so I never thought that was going to happen. But I think on a deeper level, it taught me that, one, it felt really good to put your whole self into something and not just show up and wing it, but to start to really think about showing up in your life prepared and willing to do your best and able to do your best. That was a concept that came to me late. So at 23, Now I'm starting to be around highly motivated people who take it for granted that you train hard, you race hard, and you show up and well prepared for every race. And one of the people I met along the way was Mark Allen, and he was a shining example of somebody who knew how to really work hard. And so I'm surrounded by these very, you know, hardworking professional athletes, and I had to become one of them. And it took a while, but, you know, eventually, it took about 7 years, in fact, and I finally could, I think I could call myself, you know, a professional triathlete in the truest sense of the word. And then on one other level, what did I get from that 1982 race that changed my life was that there is more inside me than I ever thought possible. And as I kept finding a way to get up off the ground time and time again and to keep moving forward, every time I thought my body was done, my mind and my spirit found a way to keep getting more out of my body. So I learned that there's much more to you than you think there is. And deep inside you, you have a will and a drive that you will not know how far it will go until you have the courage to test it. And that's why I want to circle back to you seeing my race and being inspired to put on a half Ironman distance race in your hometown. You gave so many people opportunities to test themselves and to hopefully have a life-changing experience. I truly feel like when you do your first triathlon, it's life-changing. And so, Diane, I want to say thank you so much for being one of the people who to give opportunities for someone to have that life-changing experience. I got it at 23, and I continued to apply that in my life in different ways, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but it's been my mantra, you know, go for it, jump in, figure it out as you go, and don't give up on yourself.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Julie Moss. She is the face and voice and really sort of the soul of triathlon going all the way back to 1982. She's written a new book called Crawl of Fame. Is this your first book, Julie?
It's probably my first and only book, Diane. Took me 36 years to get this one out, I don't know if I've got another one in me. And I have to give credit to my co-author, Robert Yaling. Robert and I went to Carlsbad High School together. He was a couple years younger. We had known each other in our small town of Carlsbad, California, a surfing beach community. And a couple years ago, I had read one of the books he had written about an autistic professional surfer called Just Add Water. And I love Just Add Water. And so I reached out to him and said, love the book. If you ever thought my story was worthy of telling, would you work with me? And he, you know, the response was immediate, like, yes, let's start now. And so it's been about a 2-year project, and I'm really proud to have him on board as well.
Well, the book is wonderful. Wonderful.
And, thank you.
We'll get back to more of that. You mentioned Mark Allen.
Yes.
Mark, of course, has played a huge role in your life. Tell us a little bit about how you met him and how you ended up managing two very public and very successful sports careers.
Well, I would say that Mark Allen and I knew each other from lifeguarding. He was a San Diego State lifeguard, a California State lifeguard based here in San Diego, the Carlsbad area, where I was living at the time. And I had friends who were lifeguards. I think I aspired to be a lifeguard. And just knew Mark as the guy who did really well at lifeguard competitions. Mark swam all through his college career as he was, I think, an All-American swimmer. But he was really fantastic at lifeguard competitions. So I'd see him compete, and we had mutual friends. And when I came back from doing the 1982 Ironman, I ran into Mark at a half marathon. His then girlfriend was running the race, and he was hanging out, waiting, and he loves to tell me that I just looked like I was on a pedestal. I was 10 feet tall when I walked up to him because he'd seen me on TV. And we just had a brief conversation. It's like, come on, Mark, if anyone would be good at this sport, you would. I said, and so he started training. I mean, I think the idea had already been planted, but he started training with some mutual lifeguard friends that summer. And I actually became a lifeguard. I came back from Kona, and I thought, if I can do the Ironman, I can finally pass this lifeguard test. And so I passed the state lifeguard test. I went to training. So there I was on the beach of 1982, the summer of 1982, because the race in 1982 was in February. And so I took the lifeguard training in the spring. There I was on the beach. First day on the job as a lifeguard, the Jeep rolls up, out steps my supervisor, and it's Mark Allen. So our paths were just destined to cross. And and training for triathlons. That summer, Ironman was officially moved from February of 1982 to October of 1982. So, you know, within 10 months, we had another opportunity to go back to Kona. And this time I went back with my then boyfriend, a lifeguard, in our little condo. There was Mark Gallen on the couch, the pull-out couch. So we were friends for a very long time before we actually started dating. And so I waited around for a long time for him to become single. And when he was finally single, I jumped. I just literally made myself indispensable to him and forced him to just fall in love with me. What can I say? But coming together and watching his career was really a privilege to see the talent that he had, to see how he nurtured the talent and how other people were supporting his talent. But ultimately, I've never seen anyone with the mind, just the sharp mind, and the physical talent to go with it. And so when I met Mark, you know, saw him that initial time, and he was thinking I was so great for doing an Ironman and trying to encourage him to do an Ironman. I was like, you're a diamond in the rough. And it took very, very little honing to see the amazing champion come through. So then being married and managing this career, the two careers, it was pretty easy. I was the wingman. My career never felt like it was as important as Mark's. And I don't say because I didn't value myself, but because I never saw myself being able to put as much of myself into the sport as Mark did. 1982 might have been my best effort at putting my whole soul into a race. Mark did it time after time after time. And it's still a bit of a mystery to me how he is able to commit that thoroughly to the pain level of training and then the pain level of racing, and to have the ability to be up, I mean, really get up for the big races, especially when he's a defending champion. So I was a fan of Mark Allen. I'm still a fan of Mark Allen. We're no longer married, but we share an amazing son, Matt Allen. And Diane, I don't know. I think, do you know that he's racing Kona, his very first Kona World Championship?
Yes, I do.
Yes,
and so is his, and so is his mother, by the way.
Well, his mama.
Mama.
His mama is going to be out there racing. And I just have this, the image that I carry with me for my, and I do see this as my final Ironman, at least for a decade or so, is that Mark Allen will be there to greet Matt Allen as he crosses the line. And I think that's going to be such a beautiful moment. And I think the photographers, I hope they get some great shots of that. And as Matt recovers, he's there waiting for me. And I just feel like there's this amazing torch being passed from father to son, from son to mother, and mother back to son. And just saying, this has been such a big part of our lives, this race, to have our son have the experience of qualifying to get there and then showing up for his first race and having me get to share that with him and close my chapter as he possibly opens a new one. That to me is such a, you couldn't have scripted that chapter any better.
I think a lot of people probably thought that you and Mark were still married. So they're going to have to read the book to find out what happened there.
We'll let them read that part.
Right, of course.
That was a difficult chapters to navigate.
I'm sure.
Lived. So we'll let our readers read that on their own.
Well, there are so many great stories in the book. And if anybody is interested in triathlon and sort of the very beginnings of what has made this sport so great and brought it into the Olympic field and keeps it growing, it's interesting that triathlon has its own life, just keeps expanding in some ways and drawing in new people. Unlike cycling, which has been my sport all these years and my business all these years, I still see triathlon as fresh and new. And it's very interesting who it's drawing in. You know, lots of young people, which is not happening in cycling, which is sad in a way, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. And I have to tell you, I've fallen in love with cycling again.
Oh, good.
And as much as I love my Kestrel 5000 that I'll be riding, a time trial bike I'll be riding in Kona, I have fallen in love with a road bike, and I think I'm a better cyclist on a road bike. I think it's more responsive, and it allows me to feel like I can get out there and and ride anywhere. Just ride. I mean, this whole love affair is really coming through the idea of getting on a road bike from being always on a triathlon bike.
So yeah. What's your road bike? What are you riding?
Well, a friend loaned me a Cervelo S5.
Nice.
And we have a new it's the company Canyon. Have you been hearing the word of the Canyon bike?
Yeah, I know about Canyon bikes.
Canyon has opened a beautiful flagship store here in Carlsbad, and it's really a cycling museum, I'm telling you. Nairo Quintana's bike is there. Alejandro Valverde's bike is there.
Wow.
Jan Frodeno's triathlon bike is there. And have you ever seen an extra, extra small bike frame in pink? And know it belongs to, you know, Nairo Quintana as a monster cyclist. It's so cute.
I bet it is.
Daughter's bike?
Well, you're going to be riding. Your Kestrel is a real classic.
It's a classic, yes.
Yeah.
So it's a new frame, and the bike feels really good. It wants to go one speed and straight.
Hopefully.
And
fast.
Fast. And I'm at racing at 59 years old. Fortunate that I get to race in the 60 to 64 age group. But really, my back doesn't want to be in an aero position for 6 hours. It just doesn't. So
no.
I'm not going to.
When will you turn 60?
I will turn 60 2 days after the race, October 15th.
Oh.
So the race is October 13th
right.
in Kona. And for the listeners who are interested in athletes who are going to be there, they can follow it live in real time. Facebook is streaming something. And there's also the Ironman has a tracker app that
right.
you can actually get details in real
right.
time. So I'd love to have your listeners, if they want to follow my race, that would be fun in real time.
We will be following it. I'll also, so that's the 13th, which
is October 13th,
which is 10 days from now. Julie and I are speaking on the 3rd. So I'm going to wrap up. I hate wrapping up the conversation because it's so much fun, but I'm going to wrap it up with my three favorite questions, and then we will tell people again how to get a copy of the book. Okay.
Okay.
All right. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food is anything Asian. So, and you know, specifically sushi. Yeah. So anything Asian. And I'll take it off the whole menu, but I'll order the sushi first.
Perfect. What music do you like?
I kind of like a little bit of everything. I really enjoy hearing what's new. I feel like if I can follow what's happening with what my son likes in music, then I'm sort of staying ahead of the curve. So it can be rap, it can be R&B, it can be hip hop, it can be pop or Western.
And do you have any pets?
A cat.
Well, that's a pet?
A no-name cat. Yeah, she was returned to the shelter 3 times. So this was her final home, and she'd had so many names that we just call her Kitten.
Even though she's cat.
She's a cat, but she is so much entertainment. And I go find her and bring her into my bed and make her lay there, and her purring makes me go to sleep.
Nice. Well, and we have one other thing in common, and that is yoga.
Absolutely.
And you and
namaste.
I didn't. Yes. And we didn't. Yes. Namaste. We did not talk about that. And maybe at a future time when you write your next book, we'll talk about
yoga.
Yeah,
we can talk about the benefits of yoga and training, especially I think for cycling, too. I think yoga and cycling go hand in hand. And I actually did a very intensive, 200-hour teacher training in yoga. So.
Did you really? Who'd you train with?
Yes, I did. It was through Core Power, which is, I think they're across the United States, Core Power Studios.
My favorite yoga teacher is up in Santa Monica. He's not teaching right now. He's on sabbatical, Eric Schiffman. But
of course, Eric Schiffman is world famous. He
right.
is like, he is yoga. Yes,
very
absolutely.
Good. And I have studied with him quite a few hours. And most of my students are cyclists. I should say a good 50% of my students are
very
cyclists.
Very cool.
So, yeah,
and thank you
cool.
so much again for bringing yoga to the community between being a race director and through cycling and yoga. You are really, you're making a difference.
You have made a difference right along since 1982 when you crawled across the finish line. Julie Moss, Crawl of Fame. The book is out now. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at all your favorite places. Watch the Ironman Triathlon on October 13th, and we'll see Julie and Mats Allen cross the line.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you. You have a wonderful day.
Okay.
Perfect.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My thanks to Julie Moss for her candid, insightful conversation. Her book, Crawl of Fame, was just published by Pegasus Books this week and is available at all the usual places if you'd like a copy. My thanks, too, to Christine Acosta from Pedal Power Promoters. Again, if you want more information, you can log on to pedalpowerpromoters.com. That's my show for this week, and thank you so much for listening. Remember that you can join the conversation on Facebook, send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or log on to the OutspokenCyclist.com website and leave a comment. I'll be back with a brand new show next Saturday. Please be safe out there. Have a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.